Mark chapter 5, we are following the disciples at the end of the storm on the sea. Jesus has rebuked the wind and the sea. We left off last week, the disciples more terrified by the calm than they were by the storm, looking at Jesus and then saying, "Who is this then that even the wind and the seas obey him?" And astounded. Of course, they had seen Jesus heal the paralytic, the man with the withered hand. They had been eyewitness to miracles, and probably chronologically to this time, as he raised the son of the widow of Nain, which seems to have happened before this, probably that was the most dramatic thing they had seen. But when they saw him rebuke the wind and the sea, now they're overcome with terror, as it were, and they're saying, "Who is this then?" The King James says, "What manner of man is this?" The question really seems more properly, "Who is this then that even the wind and the sea obey him?" They are about to meet a demoniac who will answer that question. They come over to the other side of the sea into the country of the Gadarenes. And they at this point are startled, no doubt, probably walking a little bit behind Jesus, having a conversation, as we would imagine these guys was. "Did you see that? What? I can't believe it. They're just..." And when he was come out of the ship, immediately, no station break here, there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs. No man could bind him, no, not with chains, because he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces. Neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stone. So Mark gives us some details, and no doubt that he had heard from Peter, great eyewitness to this miracle. Luke tells us that this man was so fierce that no one could pass by the way. We do not know how he ended up in this condition, becoming possessed by demons, no doubt in that part of the world. Besides Judaism, and we're on the Gentile side of the Sea of Galilee, there was the worship of many idols and probably many pagan practices that would leave a life open to these kinds of things. Now, by the way, in our society today, the using and selling of drugs, certainly leaving one open to spiritual realms that God had not intended that we should be open to. In the Old Testament, the use of incantations and potions, and even in witchcraft, the use of mescaline amongst the American Indians. When Paul uses the word for witchcraft and sorcery in the New Testament, he always uses the word pharmakia or pharmakos, where we get pharmacy from, and it means to use or to sell drugs. And the idea is that is the average entrance. The average American doesn't have a pentagram on his basement floor and sacrificing chickens in the basement, you know, involved in some weird thing. The average American is ignorant to the fact that if he's snorting a line of coke or crack or ice or dropping acid or taking drugs or even continually being opened by alcohol, he's unaware of the fact that he's opening himself up to spiritual realms. And in some way, this man, over the years, had first been enticed by something. Some bait is always placed in front of us. And even if it's not to the point of possession, whether it's an extramarital affair, whether it's lying because of money, whether it's power, and because of that we're willing to step on someone else or sacrifice our family. The idea is, as we look at this demon-possessed man, it isn't just the fact that he's demon-possessed. It is a desecration of someone who is created in the image and likeness of God. When we see writing on buildings today, and we see graffiti around, we see a building desecrated, that's one thing. But to realize the dignity that humanity was originally intended to realize, And to realize that human beings are the most precious thing in the heart of God. I mean, there is no other purpose for creation than for us. God took no real great pleasure in creating the beauty of the mountain ranges. It was a reflection of Him, or the orbits of the different planetary system and the constellations and all of the majesty that there is. All of that really was just lending itself to man, that God's heart was set on man. And even the stars and the sun to mark off seasons and times, it says, for man, all that God did for man. Man being the pinnacle of His creative act, in that man is created also in a spiritual realm to have fellowship with God. And man, I believe, being then the object of Satan's hatred. Satan was the anointed cherub that led worship, we are told, Ezekiel chapter 28. That he was the highest of the cherubim, the cherub order of angelic beings. And yet he himself, even as a cherub, was not created in the image and in the likeness of God. It was Adam alone that was created in the image and likeness of God, and all of creation was given to him to have dominion over. And I think it's hard for us to realize exactly what that meant. And no doubt if Adam walked with God as a physical and a moral and a spiritual being, he had access to step in and out of dimension, as Jesus, after the resurrection, would appear and disappear. It seems Adam, before the fall, had access to the throne of God and fellowship with God. And no doubt when Satan himself, when he fell, because even with his satanic genius, and he is genius, yet he still was finite, created, and God is still infinite. And with all of the wisdom that a created being could possess, he still did not know what he was saying when he said, I will be like the Most High, because the one he wanted to be like was infinite and therefore even incomprehensible to Satan. So as he falls then, the object of his hatred becomes man. And the battle, in many ways, is between man and the enemy as much as it is between Satan and God. There's no real struggle or war there. He's just a created being. One single angel will bind him and cast him into the abyss. As Martin Luther said, a single word will fell him. You know, so there is in this act of demon possession, there is a maniacal part of it on the end of Satan, a desecration of humanity. And that happens at different levels, I think, as if he can cause us to walk out on our families, if he can cause us to lie or to steal or to be involved in drugs or gambling or crime or one thing or another. And all of that is never an end in itself. It is a means to another end, because if he can cause one person to fall or one person, well, that's just the beginning. It's never the end. And you see the havoc then that's wreaked in a family. And I've seen it over and over again, all the way down to the children and so forth. So there's a desecration of humanity here. And it was taking place in our lives before we were saved, by the way. As Paul said, that God had sent him to preach the gospel of Christ, bringing people from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, into the glorious gospel of Christ Jesus. So here we see this man, sad as it is, totally possessed now, given over to the enemy, desecrated, as it were, his dignity gone, his body being desecrated, his mind gone. The enemy has him gouging himself with rocks, crying out like a beast, living in the tombs, so fierce that no one can even pass that way. And as we look at this now, Jesus is landing on the shore where this man is. Now, it tells us that when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and he worshipped him and cried. The Greek says he fell down prostrate in front of him. He ran and he worshipped him, and he cried with a loud voice. Now, you have to understand, the guys are still saying, who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? And before they even get a break, when they get on the shore, here comes this demoniac, and evidently he's got a buddy with him, comes running down, and he cries with a loud voice, you know, what have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? God, you know, and you sure they're here, when they went, you know, that was the answer to their question. Who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? The demon just said it. He is Jesus, the Son of the Most High God. Their question is answered. I'm not sure if they noticed that immediately. I'm sure that their hair stood up when it happened. I adjure thee by God. Isn't it interesting that the demons are speaking, adjuring Jesus by God, that thou torment me not? And Matthew says that before the time, that you torment us not before the time. They are well aware that there is a time set, and that Gehenna, hell, was created for Satan and his angels. The Bible tells us that. And they are well aware that there is a time appointed. You know, one of the reasons I believe that Satan will be so active as we study the book of Revelation, that as a time period begins and he realizes there's only 7 years left, and then the Holy Spirit no longer restraining, it tells us in Thessalonians, not in that he's not saving people. People will still be saved, but he's not restraining evil any longer. The church is lifted off the face of the earth, and then we have no idea what the post-rapture world would be like, because fallen angels that have been bound since the fall, since the beginning, since the days of Noah, will be released again, and all kinds of deceptive activity and power being manifest. And they understand that. And then they understand at the end of that, there is their destruction, cast into Gehenna, the lake that burns in outer darkness forever and forever. So they're crying, don't torment us before the time. And in Matthew again, they say, don't send us into the abyss, in the Greek, in the bottomless pit. Now, again, modern man may laugh at that, and it seems a little archaic, the idea of some place down in the earth. But of course, it is interesting that the only place there could be a bottomless pit would be in the center of a sphere. If this place is right in the center of the earth, then every way is up from there. And in fact, it is a bottomless pit. And that's what the Bible speaks of, that there is some place called the abyss. And freakier than that, it says there's a shaft to it somewhere. I hope it's not in my backyard. That's going to open up at some point. The shaft to the abyss. This one sees Jesus afar off. He comes worshiping. He falls down. He's shrieking and crying out, what have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not. And again, you know, before the time. For he said unto him, and here's the reason he's screaming, because Jesus had said unto him, come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, what is thy name? And he answered, saying, my name is Legion, for we are many. Now, in the Roman Legion, I believe there were 6,284 soldiers. We'll round that off to 6,000. That's enough when we come to demons. It doesn't say there were 6,000 demons, because by that time, just the phrase legion had become familiar in both Aramaic and Greek and to the Jews, and it just meant an innumerable number. So we don't have an exact number here. And then there's other information we don't have. Is Jesus talking to the man? Because some of the question is posed in the singular as you look at the verbs and in the language. And it's my personal conviction Jesus is saying to the man, calling him to the surface, what is thy name? Because Jesus tells us Satan's a liar and a murderer from the beginning. I don't know, why would you ever ask a demon what his name is anyway? You might as well ask him for his address and phone number too. I mean, you can't trust anything he's going to say to you. And you have to understand, it's important to think about that, because the church has built whole doctrines on this one verse. There is nowhere else in the Bible where we have Jesus or anyone asking a spirit what its name is. Now, we know Michael the archangel, his name is Michael. He has his name. It isn't spirit of archangel. And Gabriel has a name. He was in charge of some of the birth announcements of Christ and of some of the arrangements. He's not spirit of birth announcements. But some people have, of course, taken the ball and run with it, and they come up with the spirit of lust, the spirit of anger, the spirit of envy. Like, a spirit, you know, can only make you lust. And then if they want you to get drunk, they have to call in reinforcements. Because that spirit, as foul as he is, he's only in charge of one sin. No spirit of common sense in this theology. Now look. We don't know. Is Jesus speaking to the spirit? But there are many. Or is he speaking to the man? What is thy name? Calling this man to the surface in the midst of all of this, giving him dignity again. But for us to build an entire doctrine on one verse is foolishness. When we see the exorcists in the book of Acts that imitate Paul and say to the spirits, the seven sons of Sceva, we adjure you in the name of Jesus and in the name of Paul, come out. No, we don't have them saying, what's your name? We don't find that. And Jesus here makes the statement, what is thy name? Again, it's interesting that the question's posed in the singular, as though he's talking to one, to the man. And he answered, saying, no doubt the Spirit answering, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country, and Luke says, into the abyss here. Now there was there nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding. And Mark's the one who tells us about 2,000. And all the devils besought him, saying, send us into the swine that we may enter into them. Now they need permission. Notice that? They have to ask him permission. And forthwith Jesus gave them leave. Now in Matthew, he just says, go. And the unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down the steep place and into the sea. They were about 2,000, and they were choked in the sea. We don't know how many demons there were, but there were enough to get this whole herd of swine freaked out. And there's only one place around the Sea of Galilee when you go there where there was a steep embankment, and it is right there at the area of Gadara that goes right down into the sea. They that fed the swine ran. They fled, and the word indicates in fear. They fled and told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see Theoro. They came out to, it isn't just to glance out, they came up to observe and to study and see what was done. Their curiosity was stirred. So those of you who have not been in this study with us before, this is deviled ham. First incidence of it in the Bible. Suicide, if you will. Just get that out of the way for those that are being initiated. There are many questions that arise. Why would Jesus, and the Bible throughout upholds the right of private ownership? Why would Jesus send these swine, even though they were unlawful for the Jews to raise? Why would he allow them to be destroyed and to run down this embankment? Or did he not allow it? Did he just simply give leave to the demons and they gave another demonstration of their propensity? You know, it's interesting as we look at Satan in Job chapter 1, and he comes to the throne of God with the other angels that are there, and he says to God, well, sure, Job serves you because you've been so good to him. Just give me permission. Let me poke at him a little bit, and you'll see that he's not everything you think he is. And God says to Satan, okay, you can mess with him, but don't touch his life. You can test him. And again, if you were going to test someone to see if they were committed to God, what would you do? Someone was telling me the other day that one of the times Don McClure was back here, and he's a Scotsman, you know, and that they had a wallet on a string, I put on the ground to see what Don would do when he found the wallet. That might be something you do, or cause a very attractive woman to walk in front of Job to try to seduce him away from his. How would you test him? Well, when God gives Satan permission, he slaughters all of his children. He burns down his home. He destroys all of his flocks and fields. He's insane. He's insane. And no doubt this behavior of the swine perishing is just representative of the insanity of that realm. But, you know, people, I think, don't realize the influence in their lives of the enemy, and don't realize that he desires to kill and to destroy. And he does put bait out. And he knows how to bait us. You know, remember in John, as Jesus goes to the wedding there at Cana, and he turns the water into wine. As the master of the feast comes and tastes it, he's amazed because he said, you save the best wine for last. Normally at one of these bashes, they put out the good wine first, and when everybody's half pickled, then they put the cheap stuff out and nobody cares. And what he's really telling us is that's the way the world, in concert with the devil, works. They put the bait out initially, and it looks sweet and it tastes good, and it's when you're intoxicated with it that they put the poison out. And that's what Satan does with us, even Christians. You know, the world, the flesh, and the devil. If you would remove one of those would be no contest. If there was just the world and the devil and none of us were here, no problem. If there was just the flesh and the devil and no world to tempt us with, no problem. If it was just the flesh and the world, no devil. You know, there's a working in concert there. And I think that we have to realize what he puts out in front of us, getting us to take the first step, is when the intoxication begins. You know, it tells us that Moses, rather than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season, counted it greater riches to suffer the reproach of Christ. It tells us right in the Bible that sin is pleasurable. And we have to understand that. When we're tempted, it isn't, you know, nobody here is tempted to run out in the parking lot and chew a hole in the curb. It doesn't say that in the Bible anywhere. Do not chew on curbs. You know, this is a bad thing. We don't want to find you doing this as Christians. Who would do that? You know, there's no temptation there. Sin is tempting because it's pleasurable for a season. If you're here this evening and you don't know Jesus Christ personally, there are eternal stakes involved. And Satan will gladly give you what is sweet now, because he knows it kills forever. And himself being insane, as we see in the book of Job, he desires to take as many with him as possible. It tells us in Galatians chapter 1, Paul says, I'm amazed that you're so soon removed from the gospel of grace to another gospel. And he says, well, it's not another gospel, but it's a deformed gospel, and it has to do with this present evil age. And the word there is kakos, and the idea, I mean, porneo. Kakos, just you're miserable, you're evil in and of yourself, just the nature. But pernicious or porneo, the idea is that the evil system of this world is not content unless it's dragging people to destruction with it. Not just content to have that nature. It's there for a reason. And the enemy hating man to desecrate man. You know, we see the swine running down this bank into the sea. We see death. We see the boy possessed with a demon constantly throwing himself into the water, into the fire. We see Satan when he comes at Jesus saying, cast yourself down from here. The destruction of human dignity and the cutting off of a human life before that man is born again and sending it out into eternity without the Spirit is something that the enemy loves. And how many people think that when they kill themselves, they're going to end the pain? And then they find that from there on, the pain goes on endlessly. And the Bible's clear that a man has to be born of the Spirit before he dies physically. You can only accept Christ and be born again while you're alive physically. If you die physically, once you're dead, you no longer have an opportunity to be born the second time. You have to be born the second time before you die the first time, or there is no opportunity. Now, if you're here this evening, you don't know Christ, this is an opportunity this evening before you leave. We want you to come to the front and pray with us and ask Christ to be your Savior. And in all of eternity, this will be replayed, that you had an opportunity. You didn't go through life and God never tell you of His love or present Himself to you. There will always be on record for all of eternity that you had an easy opportunity to give your life to Jesus Christ and ask forgiveness and to come to Him and be washed and cleansed. And I pray that this evening, if you don't know Him in a personal way, you'll do that, because there is another force that would seek to destroy you. And you see, people many times don't want to come to Christ because they say, well, I want to make up my own idea. I don't like this, you know, kind of Victorian morality, and, you know, I want to make my own choices. Don't be naive. The Bible said there are spiritual forces at work. There are two kingdoms, the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of light, and there is not a third opportunity for you to make. And you have to understand the morals that are set today, the power in the media and the industry of music and entertainment and the clothes that we wear and the things that we drink and the things that we smoke and the way we spend our money. There is a menu that's set out for you. You're not choosing it. You didn't make up a particular kind of music. It was placed on the menu for you. You didn't decide what TV show should be on your television. It was put out in front of you. You didn't decide those things. And the Bible is clear. There is a moral struggle that comes upon man and wears all the way down to the spirit and to the eternal part of us. And the menu is set. Kingdom of darkness, kingdom of light. No man's a free thinker. You choose one side or the other. That's your freedom. To be bound by the enemy and to making his choices is far from free. These swine run down the embankment. They're all drowned in the sea. And they come to Jesus, the people from the village, and they saw him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting and clothed in his right mind. And they were afraid. I think that's a good definition of sanity. Sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in your right mind. They were afraid. Now they're afraid of the man sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right mind. They weren't as afraid when this demon-possessed guy was running around the territory screaming, carrying on. They just stayed away from him. They come out and see 2,000 dead pigs floating in the water and see the guy delivered sitting at the feet of Jesus. And I'm sure he was clothed with clothes by then, too. They were afraid of that. They're terrified of that. I'm amazed as I look at this. They that saw it told them how it befell, what had happened to him that was possessed with the devil. And also concerning the swine. People are standing around telling the story. They began to pray Jesus to depart out of their coast. They begin to beg him to leave now. More concerned, evidently, about the swine business than the deliverance business. More afraid of this power that was amongst them that might bring a greater destruction to their material wealth than they are about the well-being of this man. I often think it would have served them right if Jesus would have left 2,000 demon-possessed pigs in their neighborhood. That would have fixed them. Imagine that. Franco says you'd come out of Denny's and there's some pig there smoking a cigarette saying, hey, bacon breath, come over here, you know. Jump on you, beat you up. They began to beg Jesus to leave their territory. And when he was come into the ship, he that had been possessed with the devil began to beg him that he might be with him. But Jesus allowed him not, but said unto him, go home to thy friends, tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee. Now, it's interesting as I look at this. There are, you know, the demons come and worship him. And they say to Jesus, don't send us into the abyss. Let us go into the herd of swine. They beg him, and he gives them permission. They receive what they ask for. The townspeople come and beg Jesus to leave their territory, and he complies and gives them what they've asked for. The only guy in the story that doesn't get what he asked for is the guy that got saved, the guy that got delivered from demons. And look what he asked for. You know, the demons say, don't send us into the abyss. The townspeople say, get out of here. They're asking for bad things. This guy asked for the best thing. Lord, I want to be with you. I want to go with you. Who would ever think that the Lord would say, no. Now, that never happens to us because he's everywhere at once now. But then in his earthly ministry, he sends the demoniac back to the air. And when he will come, I think chapter 10 or 11, back into the area of Decapolis, multitudes come running. This guy ends up to be a great testimony and a great evangelist in that area. And many will come to Christ because of that. And there are times I think we want to do something for Jesus and he shuts the door and we have to try to understand why. In his wisdom and his foresight, he knows what will come eventually as he guides us. So he says to this guy, go on home to your family and friends. Now, of course, it's hard for me to imagine what kind of friends this guy had. You know, you can see him coming home to the house and the kids are going, Mom, he's back. You know, lock the window, shut the door, here he comes, you know. So you have his friend with him? I don't know. You know, go tell him. I always think that's strange. Go home to your friends. What kind of friends did this guy have? Of course, when I look around the room at us, I think, what kind of friends did we have before we were saved? Jesus sends us back to them to share his love. He departed, this man, and began to publish in Decapolis how great things Jesus had done for him, and all men did marvel. And when Jesus was passed over again by ship, and I wonder if the guys are thinking, here we go, another storm. You know, because they're already seeing, you know, Jesus will go through a storm to get to you if you're tormented. Nothing for him. Now the guys got to, Jesus must say, okay, let's get back in the ship and go the other way. They're thinking, boy, what are we in for now? But they passed over again, no problem, by ship, under the other side, no doubt back to Capernaum. And there, much people gathered to him. He was near by the sea. Now, as he's coming in, now, it's interesting. In Decapolis, they beg him to leave. When he gets back to Capernaum, he's thronged by the crowds. They're all around him and all over him, pushing, shoving. And behold, there cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and besought him greatly. He began to beg with all of his heart, saying, my little daughter lieth at the point of death. I pray thee, come and lay thy hands on her, that she may be healed, and she shall live. And Jesus went with him, and much people followed him and thronged him. Now, as we come to this scene, we run into these two people in great desperation, desperate people. Despairing. One is Jairus, who is the father of a 12-year-old girl who is at the point of death. And the other, and I don't know if there's any correlation for sure, is a woman who has had a blood flow for 12 years, same number of years. This little girl was born evidently in the year that the blood flow started of the other woman that is suffering. Both of them very desperate, coming to Jesus. Jairus is the ruler of the synagogue. No doubt the synagogue where Jesus had healed the man with the withered hand. And I can imagine that as his daughter. Now, Jesus had been there a day and a half earlier in Capernaum, and this man hadn't come to him. No doubt his daughter's condition is getting worse very quickly. And I can imagine Jairus' wife is saying at this point, who cares? You were there. You were in the synagogue. You saw me. And Jairus must be saying, well, if I go and fall down in front of him, the other rulers in the synagogue, the Jews are going to cut me off. We're told in John chapter 9 that the Sanhedrin and in the temple in Jerusalem had made a decree that anybody had anything to do with the carpenter from Galilee was excommunicated, was cut off. So it was costing this man everything. And isn't it funny how sometimes people don't want anything to do with Jesus till they're in a desperate situation? How many times at work, if you're witnessing to somebody or people know you're Christians or they see you reading your Bible at lunchtime, they hassle you, they make fun of you, oh, there he is again, whatever. And then, as soon as their mom has cancer, you're the first one they come to, hey, would you do me a favor? Very seriously, they approach you. Would you pray for my mom? She has cancer. And it's so funny how the tables turn quickly in desperation. And here's this man, extremely desperate. Now, a 12-year-old girl is a pretty amazing creature. I've had one and I have another one coming. The Talmud said at 12, a girl was considered a woman the day she hit 12 years old. I can attest to that. My daughter was 12. She had brushes and hairspray and clothes and nothing to wear. And, you know, she had matured. She was coming there to the full. The Talmud said a boy was not a man until he was 13 years and one day. That's when he was bar mitzvahed. But the 12 years at home with a daughter, all of the motions had been gone through. The joy, the birthdays, the playing, the dress up, all of the things they do. Talking. And my one at seven years old at home, she talks to me from the time she wakes up to the time she goes to bed. And I love it. She can talk to me forever. This man, Jairus, having the joy of all those years. Now all of a sudden it's being stripped away. Now all of a sudden the alternative of Jesus seems much better. You know, before that he probably mocked Jesus with the rulers. Before that he probably sought a way to prove that Jesus wasn't who he says he was, like your friends do. Come on, if God is God, why is this? And if there's a God of love, why does he do this? And what about the guy on the island? I don't want to meet this guy someday. Everybody's worried about him. What about that guy on the island that never hears about Jesus, you know? You know that? Why do they worry about that guy? Who is that guy anyway? And were they ever worried about that guy before you told them about Jesus? All of a sudden they're worried about the guy on the island. If you're like that tonight, you better worry about yourself, not the guy on the island, because I'm sure a missionary is going to get to him. But all of a sudden, see, all of that gets stripped away. The arguments begin to go out the window. And now he comes to the one who had healed the man with the withered hand. Jesus had been angry, looked around that synagogue, and was angry because of the hardness of their hearts. Maybe then this man's heart was hardened. But now his heart is broken. And the Bible says a broken and contrite spirit is an acceptable sacrifice before God. And you know, sometimes we look back in our lives and we think, Lord, why was I raised in a home with an alcoholic father? Why did I have to go through this great difficulty? Let me tell you something. If you're sitting here this evening and you are saved and born again by God's Spirit, we may not have the answer to all those questions, but I do know this. Better to have gone through your pain and this evening be saved than to have lived as a Rockefeller or someone with a silver spoon in your mouth, never have a problem in your life and die and go to hell forever. And this illness will be the salvation of the entire family. Though it looks like a very desperate situation, the man comes now, falls down. His religion has been no help. The law of Moses, as it were, had been no help. His religious leaders, no help. He comes to Christ, falling down, begging him. And of course, beautifully, Matthew, the 24th verse says, Jesus went with him. Much people followed him, and now they are thronging him. Now, a certain woman, which had an issue of blood for 12 years, had suffered many things of many physicians. Some things never change. And this part too, had spent all that she had. No, I'm only kidding. I thank God we have some wonderful doctors here in the church. And was nothing bettered, but rather grew worse. I mean, you have to understand, and I've got several books in my library that tell you some of the things that were prescribed for someone who had an issue of blood. Now, first of all, when a woman had her period in that day, she was put outside. She was put away from everybody for 7 days. She was unclean. She couldn't touch anything. If she sat on something, you couldn't sit on it. If you sat on it, you had to go through purification rites. If you're having her period and she slept in the bed and then you slept in the bed, then you had to be purified. She was put outside till that was over. I mean, those things are not like they are today. If the blood flow continued, she was outside, ostracized from society for the end. Now, this woman has been 12 years. Leviticus chapter 15, you can read it. It tells you all about everything that was involved. Now, The Talmud, the rabbis in that day, said that if you had a continual blood flow that passed beyond your regular menstrual cycle, and it continued over a prolonged period of time, it was because there was some immorality in your life. There was also a stigma attached to this. This woman knew in her heart she was not an adulteress or a fornicator. And that was attached to her. And she must have been saying, God, what have I done? You know, why 12 years, if you can imagine. The cures that were prescribed were taking ground ostrich egg, mixing it with fenugreek and wine, and drinking it. Another one, you took Persian onions and ground them up and mixed them with fenugreek, and everything was mixed with wine. I don't know why. You mix that with wine, and then somebody had to come up behind you and scare you. And then there was a command, arise from thy flux. Now, there's about 30 different variations of how to treat somebody with a continual flow of blood. Most of them involved astringents, like fenugreek or some herb. Some of them were completely insane. In fact, they were all pretty insane. And you can see why this woman had spent everything she had. So we know she's an adult, she's not a little girl. Had spent everything she had and was now broke financially, she's broke socially, her womanhood is stripped away. Everyone who views her as being unclean and having some moral problem. For all intent and purposes, it seems to her that the God of Israel has turned his back on her. She hasn't hugged a child, embraced a husband. She hasn't hugged a friend. 12 years. 12 years, no doubt she's anemic. Chronically fatigued. It must take every bit of strength she has now to come and press through the crowd. And to me, as I look at that, I think, what was the report of Jesus amongst the common people for this woman? Who had probably turned her back, as it were, thinking God had turned his back on her, given up on God. She has little strength, and yet the report that comes to her of Jesus, this one who has come, there is no one who he touches who is not cured. There is no one who is touched by him that is not healed, from people that are dead to lepers, to demoniacs, to blind people. To people without legs, growing their legs back. The Bible's clear that happened. Arms growing back. And whatever it was stirred in her heart. Did she get at some distance and listen to some of his words? We don't know. But there was gendered in her heart genuine faith. And she comes and pushes her way through the crowd, taking the chance. She's defiling everybody she's touching. The crowd kind of at least gave her that cloak for one more desperate try to come. And it says, she had suffered many things of physicians, verse 26, verse 27, when she had heard of Jesus, she came in the press, in the throngs of people behind, and she touched his garment, for she said, and the grammar indicates, she was saying within herself, if I can just touch, if I may touch but his clothes, I shall be made whole. She's just saying that in her heart over and over, pushing, trying to get close. If I could just get to him, I just put out my hand and touch him, I just do that. Now, it doesn't say that she touched. It says that she grasped. The idea is her knuckles turned white. She finally took hold of, and it tells us clearly, the border of his garment. As you study the Gospels, it is the kraspedon. It tells us about it in Deuteronomy. It tells us about it in Numbers, that the male Jew that was an adult was to put on the border of his garment a ribbon of blue that was to signify his relationship with the God of Israel and that he was to be separate from other people of the world. And Jesus said to the Pharisees and Sadducees, they were hypocrites. They loved to make their phylacteries wide and broaden the borders of their garments. They like to put a big, giant blue border. Now, this woman, in seeing Christ and hearing of Christ, must have thought, this is the first time in my life, because this man is amongst the common people. He loves them. He ministers to them. He eats with them. He touches them. He cleanses them. He heals them. This is the first time in my life I see a ribbon of blue that really signifies, really, really signifies a relationship with heaven. And you know, I was the same way. And I was lost in the world, taking drugs. I saw everybody with their collars. I saw everybody called themselves Reverend this, or Father this, or Pastor this. Not all of them. Obviously, there were good men, but I didn't see any who portrayed to me a Savior that would sit with common people, with prostitutes and tax gatherers and sinners, and speak to them and love them and come all the way down to where I was in life, in the strata of life, a young kid taking drugs, lost in the world. I knew nothing from church of a Jesus who would come to me and touch my life and set me free and wash my sins and give me eternity in heaven and restore my mind and my dignity and give me a life that was worth living. Until I started to see the real Jesus, until the Spirit began to draw me and people around me that were Christians began to talk to me about who he really was. And this woman pushes through and she takes hold of this border of this garment. She grabs a hold of it. She takes a hold of it. Because she's saying in herself, I can just touch it. Now, you have to realize she doesn't know the story. She's not thinking, this is where I get it. This blue border, this is when I get it. She's still thinking, am I going to defile the master? I mean, if it had been 5 years earlier and she had only had this for 7 years, would she be thinking, I still have money to go to doctors, my health is still there to a degree. This is all the way at the point where she is broken in every way. She doesn't know the story. She's thinking, I'm defiling these people. Am I going to defile him? But, oh, God, if you're really there, oh, God, if this could this one time really be a time that I might meet with you? It says immediately in verse 29, straightway the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the plague. Isn't she felt? She knew. Gnosis. She knew. Now, it's interesting because it uses a term there that's important. The fountain of her blood was dry. It doesn't just mean the flow. It means the fountain is the source of where the problem was. Whatever was causing the bleeding, immediately she felt that healed in her body. No doubt, immediately she felt an increase in red corpuscles. No doubt, immediately she felt the strength and the salts and the minerals returned to her bones. She was made whole. She wasn't just that the bleeding stopped and she went away kind of weak, but thinking, gee, maybe this really happened. She knew, because when the power of Christ touched her life, her health was restored. Her blood levels picked back up. She convalesced at the same second she was healed. Well, that's what it's saying to us here. And Jesus immediately, knowing in himself that virtue had gone out of him, turned about in the press, in the crowd, and said, who touched my clothes? His disciples, right on cue, said, what in the world are you talking about? Everybody touched you. 4,000 people just touched you. What do you mean who touched you? You know, and I'm sure Jairus is saying, yeah, what do you mean? Come on, my daughter's dying. What do you mean who touched you? Everybody touched you. You know, here's the throng. Don't you read the Bible? Throng, press, everybody's here. They're pushing against you. Isn't it interesting? Jesus, knowing that this had happened, turned about in the press and said, who touched me? His disciples said unto him, thou seest the multitude thronging thee, and sayest thou, who touched me? You've got to be kidding. He looked about, important phrase, to see her. He knew. He knew what happened. He had come there for her. He had walked that way because he knew it would intersect with the 12 years of her life. And in her heart, silently, she was slipping away, rejoicing. I'm sure the tears were flowing, crying out. No person in the crowd heard that, but all of heaven had heard it. And maybe you're here this evening, and he's passing by your way. And you know what? You only know it in your own heart. Maybe you've been saying, like she was saying, I've got to touch something. I've got to get a hold of something real. And maybe you're here tonight because his path after all these years, 20 years, I don't know, 30 years, 50 years, maybe tonight he's intersecting with your life, and he had to wait this long for you to be broken enough to reach out. That's why this story is recorded. The Bible tells us he's the same yesterday, today, and forever, that he never changes. And yes, the Bible says he's not alive physically, but he is alive at the right hand of power in heaven. And by his Spirit, he still moves amongst us. The same Spirit that raised him from the dead. And I pray that he's intersecting your life tonight. And that you understand that's why you're here, that's why you're listening to this. It's such a joy for me to realize, you know, even today, tomorrow, that in some incredible story of love, that he takes pleasure in my presence to be with me. I don't even take pleasure to be with myself sometimes, at least till after the first cup of coffee, usually. Who touched me? Now he knows who touched him, but he wants to bring her out. There are thousands pressing. There's only one touching. There's only one that desperate. There's, you know, isn't it interesting how many hundreds you know that seem to go by right by Christ? They hear the story. They hear of him. They hear the words. But there'd just be somebody in that crowd occasionally that reaches out and just takes hold of it, and their life is transformed. It's the same thing here. Many pressing, one touching. He knows. He wants to restore her, and that's what's going to happen. He turns around and he says, "Who did this?" And he looked round about to see her that had done this thing. Now, evidently, as she's getting away, feeling her health for the first time, she's thinking, "Man, I can run a 440. I haven't felt like this in a long time." And she hears behind her back, "Who touched me?" And she must kind of, boom, boom, come to a stop and turn around. It says, then he turned around to see her. No doubt their eyes met. Now, nobody else knows this transaction is going on. Who touched me? Imagine if you stopped and turned around, he was looking right at you. What would you do? Because you know why? Because if you're anything like me, you'd be think, well, if I don't admit it, he's going to be an Indian giver and take it back. And then I'll have a bloody nose too. You know, it'll be worse. I mean, what will happen here? Don't we think that way sometimes? Even after we're saved. Lord, I mean, you know, you're going to take it back, aren't you? She must turn around and their eyes meet. And it says here, I like this. The woman, here it is, fearing, trembling, and knowing what was done in her, came, fell down before him. You see the crowd parting as she comes, and told him all the truth. So everybody steps aside, and quietly they listen to her sob, saying, "I've had this blood flow for 12 years. And Jairus has got to be thinking, I have a 12-year-old daughter. Divine interruptions, they happen, you know. And I spent all my money on doctors. I've been cut off from the nation of Israel. I was convinced that God hated me. I never committed adultery. I never committed fornication. But I had this terrible stigma placed upon my life. And this was my one and my last attempt. And when I looked at the border on your garment for the first time, I saw something that was genuine. And I believed in my heart you really did have a relationship with the God of heaven. And as soon as I touched the border of your garment, I felt the healing take place right at the source. And now I know I've defiled everyone who I touched in the crowd. She must be sobbing, and she must be thinking, and I've defiled the master. No one now can be healed till he goes through the purification. Nobody. She must come with all of this on her, falling down. I wonder what she's expecting to hear from him. And the crowd is watching for his response. And you see, I think it's why he called her back. Because he didn't want her just to be physically healed. He wanted her to be restored in society. He wanted everyone there to see. Because look what he does. He says to her, "Daughter." Now this is the only time on record where Jesus calls a woman daughter, and it's my little daughter. It's the same word that Jairus used when he came to him and said, my little daughter is at home sick. Verse 23, besought him greatly, saying, my little daughter lieth at the point of death. Jesus, this woman looks up to him, you know, thinking she's defiled him, and he looks into her eyes. I wonder what the look on his face was like. And he says to her, in front of everybody, my little daughter. That's who we serve. My little daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace and be whole of thy plague. Two things. My little daughter, he says, it's the very reason I walked this way. It's the reason I came to your town to love you and to fix your life and to make you whole, to save your soul. Same reason he's given the record to us. You know, maybe you're here this evening thinking that he could never forgive you, that he couldn't touch your life. Very easy to become his daughter or his son. Simply asking Christ to forgive your sins, come into your heart. Every time I lead someone to Christ, I make that part of the prayer. Make me your daughter or make me your son, because what an incredible thing it is to become part of the family of God. Now, as Jairus hears this word daughter, that leaves him in the lurch, because that's who is dying back home. Same word. While he yet spake, Jesus, to the woman, there came one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, a certain one, and said to Jairus, now, thy daughter is dead. Why troublest thou the master any further? And you got to think, Jairus is thinking, I can't believe it. I can't believe that old lady came and interrupted. I can't believe, you know, he must be, my daughter's dead. Yeah, your daughter. Okay, she's your daughter. What about my daughter? You know, I don't know. What was he going through? I mean, just overwhelmed with grief. I don't know. Interesting. As soon as Jesus heard the word, now Jesus knows about Jairus. As soon as Jesus heard what was spoken, he turned around, spins around, and he says to Jairus, be not afraid, only believe. He stops him right away, because no doubt he's going to spiral into fear. My daughter is dead. No, Jesus interrupts his thought and said, no. Imagine that. Jesus, spin around, look right in your face. No, don't be afraid. Believe. And he suffered no man to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And he comes to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. No doubt his wife is waiting there, crying and sobbing. And he saw the tumult and them that wept and wailed greatly. Now, evidently, the professional mourners had already been brought in. They do everything quickly in that part of the world. Even today, you die, sometimes you're buried the same day because of the humidity and so forth, and because they don't go through the embalming process we do here. So we've been in Israel and see someone in the afternoon already carried down the street being enshrouded in white cloth that died that morning. So by the time Jesus gets to the house, the professional mourners were there, and they would hire them. And in the Talmud, it talks about how many you would have if you were a wealthy family, how many you hired, and so forth. So the professional mourners are there, wailing and carrying on. And when he was come in, he said to them, why make you this ado? King James, for what's the big deal? And you're weeping. The damsel is not dead. She's just sleeping. And they laughed him to scorn. And Luke adds, Dr. Luke, because they knew she was dead. They said to Jesus, you must be kidding. We're professional mourners. We already cried at three other houses today. We've seen a million stiffs. What do you mean she's not dead? Who's seen more stiffs, us or you? You must be kidding. And it says, you know these guys are pros because they go right from weeping to laughing. The house is filled with weeping. There's a big tumult. Jesus said, she's not dead. She's sleeping. Then they be, they go right to laughing. They laugh at them to scorn. Because they're professional weepers. They go right back to weeping again for a buck. They laughed him to scorn. And you have to get the sense of this. When he had put them all out, it's very much like the sense of turning over the money changers' tables in the synagogue. There's a force to this. I imagine if you were out front of Jairus' house, you see all these guys running out the front door going, whoa! I think he was driving them out. It says he put them out. Who's seen more stiffs? Get out! You know, they came running out the front door. When he put them out, he took the father and the mother of the damsel and them that were with him, and he entered in where the damsel was lying. And he took the damsel by the hand, and he said unto her, Peter is there. Peter's the one who spoke to Mark. And this phrase must be burnt in the mind of Peter for the rest of his life. Talitha kumai, the Aramaic phrase that Jesus spoke when he walked in. Talitha kumai, which is being interpreted, damsel, I say unto thee, arise. More properly, little lamb, arise. And somewhere in the spiritual realm, Jesus is sovereign. He's Almighty God. The dead body is there. The spirit, the soul, departed. Wherever it was, and it makes no difference because he's the God of the universe. He fills all of heaven. And in some remarkable way, he just says to her, little lamb, arise, and the spirit, soul, return. And immediately the damsel arose, and Mark adds, and she walked. She convalesced. Whatever had killed her is gone immediately. She just gets up and she walks. For she was of the age of 12 years, and they were astonished with great astonishment. Now, he brought her back for their sakes, no doubt, and for ours, not for hers. And he charged them straitly that no man should know it. Because the throng, the people had become crazy. The healings had become like a sideshow by this point in time. And that isn't his point. He has a message he's trying to communicate. He charged them straightly, no man should know it. And then he commanded that the parents give her something to eat. I like that. Jesus is so practical. By the way, feed her. She gets up, Mom, I'm starving. If you have a teenager, it's easier to raise them from the dead than to keep them full. Just kidding. The interesting thing as we look at this is, look, there are no methods, there are no patterns, you know, and it's important for us to realize because we have all kinds of pressure put on us by different systematic theologies and ways of thinking that you have to have faith or God can't work at this. Look, it says the man who was had the palsy, they lowered him down on the litter. Jesus saw their faith, the faith of the friends that lowered him down. The leper came to him and said, if you will this thing, it can happen. He didn't. He just said, that's the power you have. And Jesus healed him. The centurion's servant, Jesus marveled at what he heard from the centurion. And the servant was healed. He was at the point of death somewhere else, not because of his faith. The demoniac was not healed because of his faith. Jairus' daughter didn't have any faith. She was dead. The woman with the blood flow had faith. If I could only touch the hem of his garment. And the interesting thing as we go through here, it is so wrong to come up with some franchise on the way healing should take place. Jesus goes to the pool of Bethesda, and it says there are many lame and impotent folk there. He heals one man and leaves. Now, no doubt, the man who would be healed in the book of Acts at the Gate Beautiful was somewhere in that vicinity. Because Bethesda is right there by that gate in that area. Jesus was saving him for the book of Acts. As many thousands would be saved and drawn to Christ. And the point is, it's Jesus that heals. It's the same today. He's the one who does it. And he can heal today. But it isn't some individual who wields this gift around, knocking people down with his sports jacket. And, you know, it isn't like some power somebody's giving to throw around like a baseball or a beach ball or something. It even tells us in the book of Acts that the power of God was present to heal. It tells us in place that the God was there and healed to bear testimony of the word that was preached. The beautiful thing is that he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. The beautiful thing is that he's intersecting some of your lives tonight. And nobody knows it. Just like that crowd. Everybody else there was unaware, but there was one person whose life was being changed forever.